Well, welcome one and all again to this conference. Today the bishops have been following through discussions begun yesterday on the covenant and the Windsor process and looking forward for the life of the Anglican Communion. The three issues that the bishops really grappled with this morning were the proposals put forward earlier in the conference by the Windsor Continuation Group, so the notion of moratoria on certain things, the proposal about the pastoral forum, and the third topic was about any suggestions people had about the instruments of communion and the way in which they might be developed to serve the communion going forward. I must say, in my own Indaba group, there were widely different views expressed about all of those issues. The thing that struck me again today, though, was the tone in which the engagement happened. There really has been bedded down in the conference a deep, careful, respectful, prayerful kind of engagement with each other. So bishops from very different backgrounds, holding very different deep convictions, really engaging with each other at a deep level. How it all shakes down remains to be seen. The Reflections Group is working on this morning's Indaba material as we speak, and they hope to bring that together by 5 p.m. this afternoon when the final Reflections hearing will take place. And you'll see, you'll be given what they've drafted for that 5 p.m. Hearing at 5 p.m. as the hearing commences. Now, we have with us to reflect with us and respond to your questions about how it's all going and where it's all going, two bishops. Archbishop Paul Kwong, the primate of Hong Kong, is with us, and Bishop Charles Jenkins, the Bishop of Louisiana in the United States, is with us. Our spouse today is Margaret Sentamu, the spouse of the Archbishop of York, and Margaret has been working closely with Jane Williams, in fact, functioning really as a co-convener of the Spouses Conference. And Margaret will speak at the end of the conference today and give you a bit of a wrap-up of where the Spouses Conference has travelled. But first, did you gentlemen decide which of you wanted to speak first? Shall I toss a coin? Archbishops first. Thanks, Paul. Would you like to stand here to speak, and then we'll take questions from there.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And this is my first Lambeth, and I must confess I didn't go to the Indaba group this morning because I have something else to do. But I just want to give you my impression of the conference, which has been taking place in the last few weeks. And this is a great privilege for me to be part of this conference. And like any other conference, there are good and bad things about the conference. And for this conference, I found most of the things are very, very good, in particular the worship in the morning and the Bible study, where we really have a chance to reflect and share our views about our conference and our communion, and in relation to the text to the Bible. But one of the things I found it a little bit disappointing is we have spend a lot of time sharing and listening to each other, but I wish, you know, we could have more time to talk about the actions, you know, and what are we going to move from here, because it seems to me we have been beating about the bush, and we have been talking about the issues facing the communion for a long time, as coming from the Asian context, from Hong Kong in particular, we really want to see the all parties concerned would have a chance to sit down and work out something concrete to move from where we are to resolve the issues. We really want somebody, I don't know who that might be, or a team with some diplomatic skills to invite all these parties concerned and to look at the issues. And we, people in Hong Kong, respect what those people are talking about or doing, that because all these people are saying that what they do, what they have done, are correct in their context. We respect that. Now we are asking, not asking all these people to stop defending what they do are right, or stop accusing the other parties what they do are wrong. Instead, we come together and say, what sacrifice, what concessions can you make for the sake of the integrity of the communion, for the sake of our Lord, for the sake of the church? This is what we are hoping that the conference will be able to take us forward. So I would like to see if we can have some sort of these suggestions coming out from this conference, from where we can go from here to work out something, rather than simply talking about the things we have been talking about for years. And I'm not saying the listening process is not good. Actually, I treasure that. It's very, very invaluable that we have a chance to listen to each other. And this is the main purpose of this conference, to let every single voice be heard. I think this is wonderful. But instead of that, we need something concrete, some action to be taken. Thank you.
Thank you. As a disposable poor person, I am pleased to stand before you today, and I want to call to your attention a reflection of a New Testament value in this conference, and that reflection is of the miracle of Pentecost. And I remind us that the miracle of Pentecost was universal intelligibility. And in this conference, I think that Rowan Williams has taken a visionary, and a word that's not often attached to Rowan Williams, a brave posture of leadership in the Indaba process, which has assured and ensured that the small, still voices from the side are not only enabled to speak, but are also being heard. In reflecting on how the Holy Spirit operated at Pentecost, it seems to be a similar gift to the church. And I assure you that in the Indaba group in which I have participated, that even when those voices whose first language, say, is not English, have chosen not to speak, they've always been invited and urged and encouraged to speak. The second thing I want to say to you that gives me great heart about this Lambeth conference is that, yes, there are differences. But those differences do not say that we are not willing, to quote Rabbi Sir Jonathan Sacks, to share a common fate, F-A-T-E. We are willing to share that, and we see that willingness expressed in a commitment to mission. I see here something like I have seen in New Orleans, where so many of you and so many of our fellow churchmen and Christians, and even in the, as an interfaith group, have come and stood with me and have been willing to share the fate of a people who've been flooded, washed out, and then in some ways, I think, sidelined and generally excluded from the American promise. So I'll not say that we all agree on everything. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that there is a commitment to share a common fate, even with those with whom we disagree. I think that, too, is a New Testament value and somewhat of a miracle. A friend from the United States wrote to me early in this conference and said, well, is Rowan leading or teaching? And I wrote back and said, he's leading like a lion and teaching us about Jesus.
Thank you, Charles. Okay, some questions for the bishops. Yes, sir, in the back. Yep, you, sir. Yep.
Yes, the Prime Minister of Hong Kong.
You might just tell us who you are and where you're from.
Sorry. Peter Msembi is my name, BBC African Services, particularly Swahili language service. So what I'm asking, you have proposed that there should be a forum bringing the two sides together and whereby concessions have to be made. If you are to be in such a forum, what concessions would you propose be made by both sides for the way forward?
Can I answer this? I can't speak for all those parties concerned what kind of concessions should they make. But I can give you an example. You know, in the 40s, Hong Kong was the first diocese in the Anglican Communion to have ordained a woman into a priesthood, Forens Lee Tim Oi. The bishop who ordained Forens Lee was one of my predecessors, R.O. Hall, Bishop R.O. Hall. But there was, you know, that was considered a very radical move. And that was in the 40s. So, his move was strongly criticized by the Archbishop of Canterbury then and from other churches as well. So for the sake of the communion, for the sake of the church, and both Bishop and Forens Lee revoked that ordination, the ordination and stopped. And she stopped practicing as a priest because of that, and then waited until in the early 70s. One of my predecessors, Bishop John Baker, ordained two women priests, and that was widely received by the church. So I can't speak for all the parties concerned what concession or sacrifice they are making, but sacrifice is what, you know, Hong Kong is asking for. All, you know, we are not talking about rights. Every party has the right to do whatever they do in their own context. We agree that, we respect that. But what we are asking now, for the sake of the communion, we ask for sacrifice, we ask for concession.
Do you want to add anything to that, Charles? What sacrifices people might make? No? Okay, we'll move on. Yes, sir?
Harold Lewis, Church Publisher in New York. Bishop Jenkins, yesterday the bishop in Egypt said that everyone was in favor of the covenant except the American bishops, who didn't like it because they didn't want to be told what to do. Would you like to comment on this?
Who am I to know more than the Bishop of Egypt? But I would certainly say that in my Bible study, well, I'm the only U.S. bishop in the Bible study, but in the Indaba group today, when we actually did a great deal of self-revelation, I did not find any American bishop who was unable to accept the idea of covenant. I think that certainly there is a strand amongst us that goes back probably to the American Revolution that might say that we're not necessarily going to be happy about it. I personally would have hoped for something a bit more creative than covenant, though I recognized after the 98 Lambeth Conference that what we had was no longer operative or working. But I think that part of the sacrifice that most American bishops are willing to make is that we will accept a covenant, and we will accept the moratorium mentioned therein.
One American bishop in my Indaba group described himself as coming to the conference pretty much opposed to a covenant, but his support has grown exponentially day by day as he's engaged with others around this question. Down the back, yeah. Yes, sir?
Robert Finger, BBC. Sir, what do you think is lost by the failure to make sacrifices at this conference, the failure to have the discussion the way you would like? Did you want plenary sessions with resolutions and votes And do you see this as a lost opportunity once in 10-year gathering, which is failing to sort out the biggest crisis the communion's ever had?
I don't have a kind of framework when I'm, what's going to do. But I wish, there was a chance here in this conference to work on some suggestions, and how we can proceed with this negotiation process with all parties concerned to work out a solution. Allow me to give an analogy, like what's happening in the world today. We have the General Secretary of the United Nations who goes around, to different countries and trying to work out a solution to solve the problems of those countries concerned. We might have somebody like him or her, whoever, to do a similar work to help all these parties concerned to find out what kind of concession and what kind of sacrifice, to what extent these parties would be willing to commit.
Can I just Charles, first.
I would like to respond to that, and I will tell you a true story in our Indaba group this morning when American bishops talked about the sacrifices and concessions that they are willing to make, and then bishops from the Sudan talked about the concessions and sacrifices that they are willing to make. And it is possible to make a sacrifice without selling out. I believe that making a sacrifice is an act of integrity, and it is not an act of being duplicitous or, as I say, selling out. So at least in the Indaba group in which I am, of which I am part, I see that happening from around the globe.
Thank you. Down the back. Yep, sir.
In yesterday's Times of London...
Name and organizer.
Hans Eiger from Virtue Online. In yesterday's Times of London, Archbishop Henry Arambi of Uganda mentioned that the instrument of communion in the Archbishop of Canterbury is a remnant of British colonialism. And since all three of you bishops are serving in former colonies, I'm wondering what your opinion is.
Let me just start on that one. The colony in which I served was primarily French. In fact, we were sold to the United States in 1804 by Napoleon Bonaparte. And the other primary landowner in our part of the world were the Spanish. So certainly, and as far as I can tell, probably Christ Church Cathedral, New Orleans, was the first cathedral established outside of the former British Empire. I do not think that, certainly one can make that claim, I don't think one can justify that claim that the Archbishop of Canterbury is simply a relic of British colonialism. First of all, part of our heritage as Catholic Christians, as Anglicans, as being shaped in a Benedictine tradition, is a commitment to place. And it's not just the place where we are, but also the place from which our spiritual traditions have come. So certainly that critique can be made, but I don't think it can be justified. And vive la France.
Thank you. Yes, madam.
Kate Sherrod from Integrity and the Voice of Witness. You, sir, spoke about dealing with all parties concerned to talk about sacrifice, and you talked about not selling anyone out, but how is this not selling out LGBT Anglicans if you're going to sacrifice their relationships and vocations? I mean, that's what we're talking about here, and they're not in the room.
Do you want to respond to that point?
Well, that's why I, as I said earlier, we have to find a person or a team or whatever to go around, to visit and talk face to face with all these parties concerned and trying to find out, what to what extent they were willing to sacrifice, you know, it, before we can come up with a solution.
Yes, I don't think that we are, certainly they, have to think of it, there certainly were gay people at least involved in the in these conversations. That question of selling out and moving forward on the back of another is one that greatly perplexes me, and one for which I have great sensitivity. And it is a good question. All I can say at this point is a commitment to minimize the impact of something that I do upon another person.
Thank you. George?
George Conger, Church of England newspaper, for either of the guests today. It's been my privilege and misfortune to have been covering these things for 10, 12 years. And every meeting I come to, we have a discussion of process and how we're going to have this next committee. And this next committee will take us to another point. We're seeing something like that come again. What time frame is acceptable? I mean, how long is too long in conversation?
Can I respond to that initially? It's hard to say. Let me tell you about one idea that was floated in my Indaba group. This may or may not achieve support depending on what comes from other Indaba groups, but you're quite right to say that a lot of time and attention over the last 10 or 12 years on this issue has been devoted to process questions. How do we stay in communion as far as possible with these differences? It seems to a number of us that a gap has been working in a communion-wide way on the issues of substance, about the rightness or wrongness of blessing same-sex unions and ordaining people in active gay relationships. So the proposal that's bubbled up in the in my group, and in an attempt to make the moratoria acceptable to people, was to establish a communion-wide biblical and theological commission, which might work, say, from the next ACC meeting in May next year for a period of 3 years and report to the following ACC meeting. A further suggestion was that commission might move around, as Archbishop Paul has suggested, move around the provinces and conduct hearings to hear the stories of people, those on both sides of the debate who have felt hurt or marginalised. So in that way, it might incorporate something of the kind of truth and reconciliation process that was so effective in South Africa and build understanding and respect. When the commission reports, it would then have to be received. There'd be a process of reception in the provinces. So the commission would report to the ACC, but then each of the provinces would need to make up its mind about whatever recommendations might be made in such a report. And that might build on the depth of engagement and understanding and listening that's been established at the Lambeth Conference. Realistically, such a commission still might not solve all the problems. It might not achieve consensus, but it seems to a number of us that it's an effort that ought to be pursued, and we'd be no worse off in 3 years' time than we are now. Now, whether that flies or not, who knows? It's a flag that's been run up the flagpole. We'll see if anybody salutes. But a number of ideas of that sort and other quite diverse ideas have bubbled up through the Indaba groups this morning. Do you want to say anything, Charles, in relation to the question, concentrating on process and what's different? How long, O Lord?
Well, I think you better keep your walking shoes on, because we still got a while in the desert to go. And I think what I would suggest to the church is that let's stay in shape, because we're going to be walking for a while. And I'm not sure, George, that this is going to have a technical fix. I'm not sure that a commission is going to find a consensus. The fix may well be adaptive.
Bishop Jason, Matt Kennedy from Stanford Faith. Bishop Jenkins, you said that your impression was that all sides are willing to live within the moratoria.
That is correct in the Indaba group in which I attend.
Okay. There's been some confusion about the distinction between authorizing rights for same-sex unions and actually allowing same-sex unions to take place. Is it your understanding that those in your Indaba group are willing to halt all same-sex unions taking place or just stop any sort of rights from being created?
I have no impression on that one way or the other, Matt. We didn't go there.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. I want to go back, please, to the notions of sacrifice and concession, since Christianity is, of course, built on the potential holiness of sacrificing. What I wonder is, do you see a difference between sacrificing oneself on behalf of others and requiring others to sacrifice themselves on your behalf? And if you do see a difference, then what are the implications of that for even a 3-year moratorium on the lives and vocations of gay and lesbian people?
Yes, I think there is a big difference, and that difference is certainly obvious. I think our Bible study reading for this morning indicated that when the nation requires one to be sacrificed for the sake of the nation, that's very different than one offering oneself. And so I think that you're pointing to a moral dilemma that is a dilemma for me.
We have a Chinese saying, you know, the little we, has to sacrifice for the big we. In a sense that, you know, for the sake of the well-being or the best interest of the big we, the little we has to make any sacrifice or any concession. You know, they are willing to.
We'll take two more, I think, and then we better give Margaret a go. Yes, madam?
Solange DeSantis from Episcopal Life Media. There are a couple of difficult issues in the Windsor continuation process and the covenant design process. Certainly the moratoria, whether there's an enforcement mechanism, what happens if a province can't sign off. Did you hear in your Indaba groups difficulty expressed around these issues also?
I think the areas where there's most contention is on the appendix, the procedural appendix, which is about, you know, processes and how people will be dealt with. The covenant is not setting out to be punitive. It's an opt-in process. It's designed that way so that a church may relinquish its participation in the covenant group, or the ACC might decide that for all intents and purposes a church has relinquished its participation, but there are no sanctions other than that. I mean, what might flow from that is still being talked about, whether that would mean no invitations to Lambeth or you lose seats on the ACC if a church opts out of the covenant relationship. Those kinds of things might be possible, I guess. But equally, there's immediately established a process to seek reconciliation with that church. Do you want to add anything, Charles, to that?
No.
Okay.
No,
yeah.
I don't have
Paul?
Anything to add, no.
Last one, sir.
Steve Waring, Living in Church magazine. In Nottingham, at the ACC 13, their Episcopal Church was, and the Anglican Church of Canada were recommended that they not have any seats on any elected bodies until Lambeth. Is there any decision on whether they can now be on those bodies, or was that a specific time limit?
The Windsor report requested that the Anglican Church of Canada and the Episcopal Church voluntarily withdraw from the ACC until the next Lambeth, and both those churches graciously acceded to that request. I'm not aware of any discussion here that sought to continue that or adapt it in any way.
Yep.
Charles?
No.
Okay, well, thank you. It's 2:00. We better hear from Margaret and allow a little bit of time for questions in relation to the Spouses program. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you, Bishop Philip. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, the Spouses program has followed the same subject matter as the bishops, but in a slightly different way. We've tended to focus, first of all, on storytelling, sharing our own stories, our own personal journeys, but also vocational and spiritual journeys to Lambeth Conference. And those stories have been extremely wide-ranging and some of them really heartrending. Just to give you a flavor, we had a story from Anna from Madagascar, whose husband has to walk 8 miles to get to church because there isn't a public pathway or proper road to do that. And he's away from home for anything up to 6 weeks at a time. So here is Anna, who has to hold together a household and keep the family together, and also remembering that she resigned her job as a leading product development manager in another country, in Mauritius, following her husband's consecration and relocated to Madagascar. There's a very painful story, but one which Anna is living with and working with great joy and fortitude. Then there is a story of Mugisa, who's from the Congo. As many of you know, Congo suffered a lot, many, many years of conflict and still does. And she and her husband felt called to come and exercise the ministry and the role of reconciliation, bringing together two ethnic groups. They moved from Katanga province to Mboga Zaire province to mediate peace. And that has not been easy at all for her. Amidst that, soon after they'd arrived, her husband was arrested and his life was in danger. And had it not been for the intervention of the then Archbishop of Canterbury and others, he would not be alive. But when you hear Mugisa tell her story, again, you're very touched by the passion and the commitment with which she feels called to minister alongside her husband. And it's such stories which put me to great shame, and indeed it humbles us, those of us who have the privilege of ministering in the global north, that many of us have the choice to work alongside our husbands, spouses, or not, or have the choice to exercise what I call a world-facing ministry instead of a church-facing ministry. When one hears stories like the ones I've just recalled, it makes my problems pale into insignificance. So it is very humbling, and it's been a good learning experience sharing with our brothers and sisters across the communion. So we have used storytelling. The other method we have used is that of theatre and drama. And this has worked to great effect. In fact, we shared one of the sessions with the bishop using the Riding Lights. Some of you may know that group. And that's been very powerful. There were times when there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. And just to tell you of another story of our brothers and sisters in Melanesia. Again, they told a story of how they put themselves physically in harm's way in order to help bring about reconciliation. And 7 of their brothers were murdered. We've also done things with our hands. We've created the vine, which again is very symbolic. And the vine illustrates our interconnectedness. We have taken photographs. We have made leaves to go on the vine. And we have taken pictures, a photograph of the vine, and created a bookmark. And each spouse will leave the conference with that bookmark as a reminder of our time together. There is immense diversity in the spouses' conference, but we have not seen this as a barrier, but as a blessing. And we have sought to work with it. And we have sought to focus on those things which unite us. Having said that, we also carry the same burdens that our spouses, the bishops, do carry, because we talk to them. And we also want to practice the unity that we all are praying for as a church. We share those burdens, but we are seeking to focus on those things that unite us. And we hope and truly believe that according to Colossians, we'll be able to carry our diversity into unity by being compassionate, by being kind, and by being patient and bearing up with one another. We have learned to share together, to eat together, to cry together. We've been out we've enjoyed the Kentish countryside and had lots of fun there. And we shall go away taking with us in our hearts the men and women we have met at this conference. And above all, we're going away determined to do something, each one of us as individuals, but also to encourage our dioceses and provinces to do something to reach out to our brothers and sisters across the continent. Finally, this morning, in our final act of liturgy, we were all invited to eat a cherry and not to swallow the stone, and to put that stone in, to plant the stone in a little bowl, and we gave that little stone in the soil to one of the English spouses to tender, because we believe this is a real symbol of enjoying the sweetness of gathering together and being together for these 2.5 weeks, but also recognizing the hardness that hard stone represents, the toughness of people's lives and context, but also looking to the death of that seed, but into resurrection. So we're going away as a people of hope. Thank you very much.
You might like to stay there. Take some questions about the spouses, yes.
Santamo Solange DeSantis, Episcopal Life Media. There's been a lot of talk in the context of covering the bishops of bishops who are not here, who are boycotting the conference. It occurs to me that, of course, their spouses are not here either. Any indication that the spouses all would also have welcomed those spouses who are not here?
As I understand it, the invitation to the conference came from Ron Williams and Jane Williams for the spouses. And personally, we are sorry that our spouses were not able to come, but we still believe they are part of our fellowship and our gathering. And we are sending out messages of prayer and concern and saying, we missed you. It's like holding a party, inviting someone to a party, and for some reason or another, they're not able to attend. So it is with great sadness they were not able to join us, but they are prayerfully in our thoughts.
Thank you. Another one? Yes. I accidentally called someone who'd already asked a question, so let's try and give everybody a chance. Yeah.
This is Sentinel Sherry Wetzel from the Anglican Voice in Dallas. I am a priest's wife, and I belong to a large group of priest spouses in Dallas. Do you have a word of encouragement from them that you have gleaned from this conference?
For the priest spouses?
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Well, all I can say is that this has been a worthwhile exercise. It has not been money wasted, because it's when you engage and face to face with someone that you really seek to understand those strong bonds that hold you together. So I would encourage the clergy spouses in North America to keep the faith and continue to exercise the ministry they believe God has called them under God.
One more. Yes.
Jane Still, Anglican Man in Melbourne. We've heard some very powerful stories about the work that many bishops' wives particularly are doing in the areas of reconciliation and community building. Given this really practical and grassroots ability, do you feel that the bishops' spouses have enough of a voice across the global Anglican communion that could talk into some of the conflict that the communion itself is experiencing?
I believe there is great opportunity, and from the conversations I've had with the women, they're not doing things in the back room, as it were. Particularly if you listen to the spouse from Burundi, she really has a voice on a bigger platform. And a lot of women are like Matilda. They're opening orphanages, they're interacting UNICEF and also the United Nations. So they are getting through to the bigger platform. But as usual, we look to our bishops and archbishops to support us in that work. So there is potential, and some people are maximising that potential.
Thank you, Margaret. I did say last one. One more. Go on.
Stephen Brown, Ecumenical News International, Geneva. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. Just to build on that last question, do you feel that there's a role that the spouses of the bishops can play also in helping to create that understanding within the Anglican communion itself about the differences that the communion itself faces?
I think spouses do play an important role, and they're already playing it. It's not being done in the public arena, but we, as a spouses conference, we're seeking to model unity. We're seeking to model working together. And as I said, we're not immune to the struggles and pains the bishops are going through. But we are already modeling reconciliation on the ground and in the way we have engaged. We have engaged in Christianly conversations, in our Bible study groups. Some of these issues have really emerged, but we have sought to engage with in a very Christianly manner, seeking to reach a common mind, knowing that we will not agree, but still we continue to journey together.